a whistle while you work. Ah, hello there, cinephiles, and welcome to a brand new episode of Silver Screen Cinema Classics. Today we're going to be opening the old Disney vault and looking at a bona fide influential cinematic icon. It is Walt Disney's first feature-length animation, the first ever animated feature film produced in the United States, and the first cel animated feature film. And love them or loathe them, it's the latest Disney film to have a live-action adaptation, which is in cinemas pretty much right now. So what better time for a deep dive into the legendary 1937/1938, more on that later, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I am your host, the Magic Mike Mirror, joined by my own loyal woodland helpers, the lovely and definitely not evil sci-fi queen, Nita.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome back. All ready to talk all things Snow White?
Absolutely.
Awesome, awesome. She did offer us an apple before we started, but we all just declined just to be on the safe side, you know.
Anyway, oh, we were supposed to decline it?
Oh, no! And, yeah, as you can hear, we're also joined by, she's the fairest in all of our Discord, but don't tell Adrienne. She's not Snowy, but she is Sandy. Welcome, Sandy Evanson.
Hello, hi again.
Hello again. Welcome back to Cinema Classics. You seem to be getting to be a bit of a regular on this one.
Yes, especially how could I pass up reviewing something like this, something so classic from our childhoods?
Absolutely, and just influential in film history as well. So, yeah, we're going to break down Snow White's influences, inspirations, impact, and more. But before we do, I have to ask the question that I always start with to give us a little bit of personal context and put our guests on the spot a bit. Do you remember the first time you saw this movie? I probably have to think way back in this instance, and what your initial thoughts of it were. And Nita, I'm going to come to you first and ask you that.
Actually, you know, it's funny because I was just thinking about that. And yeah, I actually can remember as a child watching this. Maybe I can remember watching it when I was maybe 6, 7 years old. And I thought it was so good. And I, you know, when you're that young, you're so naive. You don't really see anything and in the perspective that you do as an adult. But I thought it was so great. So, you know, oh, the prince, he's so handsome. And I love the music and the dancing. And I thought the dwarves were funny, you know. And I could totally believe that she will find herself in the woods and find a little house to sleep in and be yeah. taken in so easily. Like, why wouldn't that happen, you know? It was a different experience watching it as an adult when I watched it for the podcast today.
Okay. I'm intrigued to hear how it hit you differently then. But yeah, I think fairy tales are for the children, and we never question any of it really when we're young, do we? We just go along
exactly.
with the story.
But I think that's the point, right?
Oh, completely. Yeah. And what about you, Sandy? Do you remember your first time?
I remember watching it when I was very young, but I don't know if I do remember my first time, but it was... you know, on television, probably at my grandmother's house, because that's, you know, those were the ones who catered to me and would put things like this on for me when I was that young. I remember it just being very magical. I don't remember, you know, too much about my specific thoughts about it. I remember the forest scene was scary. It was very scary. I think I even would look away. So, you know, animation, I guess what we typically got, this felt so much more realistic and was state of the art when we were younger, even though it was came out in like 1940 or what have you, it was still ahead of its time when I was watching it, I recall.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 1937/38, actually earlier than 1940, believe it or not. So yeah, the 30s was out. But yeah, it's weird to hear you say that, because I was actually going to say it would be at my grandparents' house that I first saw this as well, because they were they would look after us while my parents were working and stuff. So that would be where I would always be watching, you know, cartoons and Disney stuff and whatever. And I can't remember the exact first time. I know I would have been really young, like probably 5 or so, because, well, that was when we would just stay at my grandparents. And I can't remember if it was on TV, which it may have been, or it may have been a video cassette back then, but an old video VHS, because my grandparents did have a few of the Disneys on video and had a video recorder back then. But yeah, I just know it must have been around then, because I know that we did an adaptation of the Disney version for a school play when I was back in first school, when I must only have been about 7 or 8, and I was really familiar with the story already by that point. So I must have already seen it a few times. And yeah, it's such an ingrained part of childhood that it just feels like, I can't even really remember the first time I saw it, because it was just one of those things that's always been there. It was one of the first things I think I've ever really remember seeing and registering. And, you know, as a kid, you probably do. Obviously, you watch TV and kids' TV and stuff, but you don't take any of that really in. It's just kind of, ooh, bright colors and shapes. And I think this was one of the first memorable things that I watched. So, yeah. Strange that we share that in common with our grandparents showing us things when we were younger. Cool. So, yeah, I'm intrigued to hear you guys' thoughts about the movie now that you've, I assume, watched it for the podcast as adults. I've seen it a few times.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm going to ask a question here now that I never normally ask, but I hear DK ask a lot in the cult classics, and I'm going to potentially co-opt it because I'm intrigued. How often would you say that you do watch this movie? Is it something that you go back to often or that you haven't seen in absolutely years? And I'll ask you again, Mita, first.
I actually haven't seen this original version in years. So when you asked me to be on, I was excited to rewatch it. But I have seen it quite a few times. It's just been a long time since the last time.
Yeah.
Quite a few years. I would say like a good 20 years.
Oof, wow.
Yeah. Well, I'm dating myself here.
Cool. I think if you're not a bit of a Disney nerd like me, you're not really gonna watch it all the time, but I like to chuck on a Disney film every now and then. So I have to say I can't remember exactly how long it's been, probably a fair while, because it wouldn't be the first one I reach for in my Disney collection, as opposed to sort of the Lion King, Aladdin, the ones that I absolutely adore. But I will have watched it at some point when I've just felt like watching a short and sweet Disney film, or chucked it on Disney Plus if I've been doing something and just wanted something in the background. So
exactly. Yeah.
What about you, Sandy?
Same as you, Mike. But it hasn't been that long since I watched it, maybe about 3 years. And it's just purely a nostalgia thing. We'll put it on from time to time. Me and my daughter, she's 26 now, and then my sister's a huge Disney fan and has a really lovely singing voice, unlike myself, and she's in her 30s, so we'll just watch it sometimes for nostalgia's sake, or like you said, I'll put it on for something in the background to sing along to. Although I do have a preference for, you know, a couple of, usually I'll reach for like actually Cinderella, I like so much more. Okay. But this is something I will watch maybe every 5 years or so, every few years.
Yeah, cool. I mean, it's obviously popular, and as you say, it's very watchable. And I think we have to kind of acknowledge its place as the very first Disney film, as I'm sure I'm going to get into more as we go on. But yeah, so to jump us into the actual bulk of the episode, I'm going to start, as we always do, with a behind-the-scenes section. Apologies if it's a little dry. I'm going to try and not be too long. And if there's anything you guys want to comment on or you want any clarification, feel free to jump in and ask. But otherwise, I'm going to jump straight into it and say that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is a 1937 American animated musical fantasy film produced by Walt Disney Productions and released by RKO Radio Pictures. It's based on the 1812 German fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm. It premiered at the Carthay Circle Theatre in LA, California on December the 21st, 1937, and went into general release in the US on February 4th, 1938. That's why it has two different release years, as I explained up top. It's officially regarded as a 1937 movie, but in all honesty, it's 1938, I would say, so there we go. Despite initial doubts from the film industry, it was a critical and commercial success, with international earnings of more than $8 million during its initial release against a $1.5 million budget, which was still very high in 1930s. It became the highest grossing film of 1938 and briefly held the record of the highest grossing sound film of all time. It was also the highest grossing animated film for 55 years. The popularity of the film has led to it being re-released theatrically many times until its eventual home video release in the 1990s. Obviously, it's been released several times on video, Blu-ray, and now 4K, which I watched. Everyone take a drink. That's what I watched it in, so there we go.
I love it.
Adjusted for inflation, it's one of the top 10 performers at the North American box office, and it is still the highest grossing animated film with an adjusted gross of $2.297 billion. Wow. That's big numbers. I have a quote from Walt Disney on choosing why he chose Snow White for his first feature film. He said, "I don't know why I picked Snow White. It's a thing I remembered as a kid. I saw Marguerite Clark in it in Kansas City one time when I was a newsboy," referring to, I think, a stage play version. "They had a big showing for all the newsboys, and I went and saw Snow White. It was probably one of my first big feature pictures I'd ever seen. That was back in 1916 or something, somewhere way back. But anyways, to me, I thought it was a perfect story. I had the sympathetic dwarfs and things. I had the prince and the girl, the romance. I had the heavy. I just thought it was a perfect story." And although the Disney studio staff were excited about the project, they were unsure that the full-length cartoon would sustain an audience's attention. Ward Kimball, who worked on the film, said that they were told by Hollywood moguls, such as W.C. Fields, that, quote, "it was okay 6-7 minutes like the shorts, but an hour and a half, no way. Big reason was that you run out of funny things to do. You had to have a laugh a minute, and the bright colours would hurt your eyes. Everybody would get up and walk out." So, yeah, we know how that turned out. Of course, Walt Disney plugged ahead. He didn't believe any of that. He felt that if you had a solid story, not only laughs in it, but tragedy, it would go. Both Disney's wife Lillian and his brother and business partner Roy attempted unsuccessfully to talk him out of it, and movie industry insiders derisively referred to the film as Disney's folly while it was in production. So no real faith in it. The prototypical animated feature Snow White pioneered the use of fairy tale adaptations, the inclusion of original songs, and various technical innovations, which all contributed to it becoming a major milestone in the early animation industry, and its influence is still felt today. Snow White is widely regarded as one of the greatest films ever made and credited with creating the new form of the golden age of animation. Disney's take on the fairy tale has had a significant cultural effect, resulting in popular theme park attractions, a video game, a Broadway musical, and the aforementioned live-action film, among many, many, many other things. Just a quick note on the, you may be wondering about why it's referred to, I know I do, as Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Apparently, when the movie was released, it was generally accepted that the correct plural form of dwarf was dwarfs. The uncommon variant dwarves that we all seem to use nowadays was popularized by J.R.R. Tolkien in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, which is why we don't use dwarfs as much now. I found fascinating because I had no idea about that. So there you go.
I have a question. I don't know if either of you can answer, but back then that's the word that we used, dwarfs. Mm-hmm. But are we still using that? Am I wrong to think that little people is the politically correct and acceptable term now, or are we still using dwarfs?
It depends on what you interpret it as. I interpret this as these are the magical creatures as opposed to being humans with dwarfism. There's a reason why we still refer to like Gimli in The Lord of the Rings as a dwarf. It's not that he's just a short person. It's the actual species, you know? So mm-hmm. I think that's why I would say it's probably okay in this context. But, you know, your mileage may vary. If you have an issue with it, they have taken, I've noticed, the "and the Seven Dwarfs" part out of the live-action remake, and it's just called Snow White, perhaps to avoid that controversy. So
it's probably, I can see that. That's why I asked, because I know that the live-action only calls it Snow White. So I was confused. I was like, I wonder. So I figured, hey, why not have a little bit of a discussion about it, right? And learn.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I said, it depends how you look at it. I mean, if you want to read them as being just little people, then I can understand why you're thinking offensive. I always just assumed they were dwarves in the kind of, like I said, magical way. Fantasy sense, you know, like magical creatures. But yeah, fair enough. I think that's certainly the intention, because they're based on the old German folklore kind of things where you always had like trolls and goblins and, like I said, dwarves obviously would be part of that as well. So anyway, did you guys have any thoughts on anything that I haven't mentioned about the behind the scenes making of the film? Any questions, any other kind of thoughts or feelings about it?
One thing I read that I thought was interesting, that Walt Disney used the $5 a gag incentive.
Yes.
So I thought that was neat, a way to like get lots of ideas, kind of like how I imagine SNL works. Like they just get no idea is a bad idea, and you know, we just want volume so that we can pick the best to put in the movie. So I thought that was interesting to learn. I just read that today.
Yeah, absolutely. I read that Walt Disney saying there's no bad ideas, and asked all of his staff to contribute any gags they wanted, and he'd pay them $5 a gag. And apparently the very first one he got, or one of the first ones that ended up in the movie, was the idea of the dwarves all poking their head over the bed frame when they first see Snow White. That's how that came about. Just a random suggestion by one of the audience or the studio workers. So, yeah, pretty cool. I like that scene. It's good. It's a funny little moment. So, Awesome. Right, I'm going to jump into talking about the acting then, which is the next section that I would jump into, just because I have little sections and we tend to keep to them, or as I say, if the conversation flows a different way, we follow it along. So I'm sure you guys are familiar enough, certainly our guests are, with the way we do things. So if not, don't worry, it'll all become clear as you're listening along. I'll just jump in with a little bit of background information on the acting first. Again, I have a quote here from Walt Disney, who talks about casting Adriana Caselotti as Snow White. He said, "I wanted to get a voice for Snow White that would be kind of away from everyday, you know, kind of off in another world. And I was hunting for a certain quality voice, so I had a boy searching for voices. He went everywhere. I wanted someone who could sing too, because I was going to use a lot of songs. So we kept bringing these people in. So one day he came in with a voice. I listened to it. I said, that's perfect. She came from an opera family. She could do all this beautiful stuff. So I hired her." The studio auditioned over a dozen actresses for the role of the Queen before Lucille Laverne was chosen, although several members of Disney staff contended that she sounded, quote, a little old for the part. Having portrayed similar characters in Orphans of the Storm, 1921, and A Tale of Two Cities, in 1935, Laverne also tried out for the role of the Old Hag. Under her initial test, the animators rejected her as her voice was being too smooth and not rough enough. She went out, came back in, recorded again, and sounded perfect. And when they asked her what she did differently, she said that she simply removed her false teeth. So there you go. Snow White was sadly Laverne's final film performance before her death in 1942. But what a performance it is as well. I think it's fantastic.
Yes, I think it's a legendary performance. She was really good.
Yeah, and I mean, you do really tell the difference between the Queen and the sort of hag disguised version. And to hear that story, the funny story about, oh, I just popped out and took my teeth out and that's how I got that voice, you know, brilliant. And regarding the dwarves, whenever Doc speaks, he uses malapropisms and spoonerisms. If you're not familiar with that, it basically is where you shuffle either letters or words around, as I'm sure if you've seen the film, you'd remember Doc doing. So things like, oh, we have to go down and bring her up. I mean, up and bring her down and things of like that nature. This was in part why the comedian Roy Atwell was hired for the role. His comedy act involved characters who were often misdelivering lines or stammering. Apparently, he was recording a pretty straight comedy gig one night, started tripping over his words, realized he got a bigger laugh that way, and it just became his deliberate act. So there you go. Yeah, and that's all I have on the acting. So, again, before I jump into talking a little bit about, you know, my thoughts on it and feelings personally, I'm going to come to you guys and open up the floor. Do you guys have any thoughts on the acting and the, well, voice acting, I would suppose it would be all what it would be in this film? I know there's not a lot of characters, but, you know, Snow White, the Queen, the dwarves. And Sandy, I'm going to come to you first now, just to mix it up a little bit. Any thoughts on that?
Just that it was very, again, for something that they were trying that was new, that was a great experiment for Disney. I thought it just did really well. The voices match up to the characters. And I don't know, again, if it's just from looking back, if that's how they, but the voices they gave them, everything just seemed right. There was just never a moment that anything was unbelievable or I was taken out of it. In fact, the voice acting just, you know, draws you in and brings it to life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And would you say the same, Nita?
I think that they were just so good. It really brings the characters. It gives the voice acting gives the characters this realness. Because I think that when we look at the Queen and the Hag and Snow White, you can really see the reality of what you're watching. You know, these are people, you know, they're not just cartoons, and what's happening, and it really draws you in. And I think that a voice actor that can draw you in and make you feel like you're watching a live action as opposed to a cartoon, it has really gone above and beyond their job as to just interpreting the character. Right. I think they did a fantastic job. I mean, even the voices of, you know, the seven dwarves, they were so wonderful and well done. I really did enjoy, I think this time around, in a different level as an adult watching it, this movie. I could appreciate the technology, the limited technology they had to work with to present such a quality movie.
Awesome. Yeah, I would say the same, and it's veering into the writing a bit, but I think the characterization of this is a big part of why it works, because like I said, the characters are not two-dimensional. They all get, well, almost all get quite a lot to do. And if you think of the movie, you'll think of the way that Grumpy is characterized, or Doc's kind of kindly but dizzy demeanor, or like I said, Snow White, or the fantastic performance. For me, the strongest performance in the movie is Lucille Laverne as the evil queen and the hag, who I can remember, like I said, scared the poop out of me when I was younger, because that's just such a good villain performance. It's iconic for a reason. And good luck to Gal Gadot for trying to top that in the live action movie. I can't imagine it's going to hit quite the same way. But yeah, so
it really raised the stakes, right? The voice acting and how scary she was. It like made the stakes very real.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, because the queen, I felt like, yes, she was this strong, evil woman, but the hag, the old hag, was meant to frighten you. She was meant to embody that part of the queen that was scary and frightening and dangerous. And for anyone to try to do that and really make the mark that this actress did, it's going to be a challenge. That's what big shoes to be stepping into.
I completely agree. I would say, and I did find the hag really scarier, but I think I was equally, well, not equally, but a little bit less scared, but you know, still scared by the kind of the evil queen version, when she's kind of speaking to the mirror, and especially when she's commanding the huntsman, you know, go and kill Snow White, and you know the penalty if you fail. I'm kind of, oh, this is quite chilling
more
in its own.
Angry at her, though. There was more like anger and kind of hate, whereas opposed to the hag, it's like pure fright.
Yeah. Yes, agree.
Yes, I think,
agree. There was this, and there's a tone of jealousy in the queen that you really can hear.
Yes,
And then there's this hate, like Sandy says, in the hag, and this fright that you really can hear. And that's kind of important when you're doing voice acting, is to hear the emotions, not just see them, because what you see is someone's interpretation, someone's cartoon drawing. And I think that the voice is going to give it that sense of realism.
Definitely, yeah. And I think it's kind of become, I don't know if there's any, you know, real evidence of what we picture kind of evil witches as before this movie, but certainly it's become iconic as, you know, if you think of a witch, you think of, you know, the black cloak, the white hair, the wart on the nose kind of thing, which comes from this movie. You know? So, yeah, very interesting. And I do have to shout out one more person before we move on, which is such a powerful performance with very few lines, but I really like it, is Maroni Olson, who was the original voice of the Magic Mirror. Yeah, definitely have to shout out that performance because it's so good. It resonates and it's got such power to it. So yeah. Cool. Well, I'll jump into the writing then. And again, I have a little bit of information before we start the discussion. I'll tell you that the story is by a lot of people: Ted Sears, Richard Creedon, Otto Englander, Dick Rickard, Earl Hurd, Merrill Damaris, Dorothy Ann Blank, and Webb Smith. But based on the Brothers Grimm tale that I mentioned earlier. The earliest known story outline was simply titled Manuscript and was compiled by staff writer Richard Creedon on August the 9th, 1934. It featured 21 pages of suggestions for characters, scenes, and songs, including Someday My Prince Will Come, which was there from the start. Story suggestions included the Queen having a collection of her former enemies reduced to a few inches in size, a Gilbert and Sullivan-style musical number for the scene where the Queen orders the huntsman to kill Snow White, and a sequence of the Queen trying to break the mirror upon learning that Snow White has survived, with the mirror detaching itself from the wall and smashing against the Queen after chasing her around the chamber. Can't imagine why that didn't happen. I would imagine probably because it would be very difficult to animate even nowadays. Disney also decided from the beginning that each of the seven dwarfs, whom he considered to be the strongest lore of the story because of their comedic potential, should have a distinctive personality identified by a respective name. A pool of over 50 possibilities were compiled, and deep breath, get this, with names initially such as Hoppy, Sneezy Weezy, Big O Ego, and Awful as the top contenders, along with later additions Wheezy, Jumpy, Baldy, Hickey, Gabby, Nifty, Sniffy, Lazy, Puffy, Stuffy, Shorty, Wheezy, Burpy, and Dizzy.
I think I like the names they settled on better.
Yeah, I think they kind of settled on the right ones, I think it's safe to say. Although I am curious what Big O Ego would have been. Just a really pompous guy walking around, hey,
That's grumpy.
it's more kind of Gaston from Beauty and the Beast, really, isn't it? So, yeah. from the outset, Disney decided to discard the part of the original story where the Queen tries to kill Snow White with a tightly laced bodice, but he considered retaining the other two attempts with a poisoned comb and, of course, a poisoned apple, which is the only one that did end up in the film. Yeah, and we've already mentioned Disney encouraged people to contribute their own gags. The other thing I wanted to mention personally, which kind of, it's a really nerdy kind of nitpick sort of bugbear of mine, but the line in the movie, as I'm sure you all know now, is magic mirror on the wall. Mirror, mirror on the wall is along with things like beam me up, Scotty, Luke, I am your father, or play it again, Sam. An iconic phrase that has entered cultural lexicon despite not actually being said anywhere in their respective movie. The line mirror, mirror never appears. I don't know why it became thought of that there was that double use. It's always just magic mirror on the wall. So you go. If you didn't know that, that's quite fascinating to learn, I think. So yeah, were you two aware of that, or just because you watched the movie, were you wondering why it didn't sound the same?
I thought maybe it had changed over the years. I never really realized that it, you know, because I was like, well, maybe I remembered it wrong and she doesn't say it in this one. Maybe in the remix or in movies that, you know, the later ones, maybe she says it there, because I was expecting mirror, mirror on the wall.
Yeah, we all do. It's kind of, like I said, it's part of our cultural history, and there's been a sort of a movie version called that. There was an episode of Star Trek called that in supposed reference to this in the 60s, mm-hmm. and yet it's not said in the movie. We just kind of, we misremembered it, and it became sort of accepted that that happened, even though it didn't. It was a false memory, kind of a weird, Mandela effect situation, I think.
Exactly.
Definitely. I'm surprised to hear this, and I didn't even notice I didn't hear it.
You didn't notice. Fair enough. Yeah, now you know. Cool. So, yeah, in terms of the writing and the plot, then again, I'm going to throw it open. Nita, I'll come to you first. Any thoughts on the writing and the plot of this movie?
I like the idea for a fairy tale. I think this is a perfect kind of idea of teaching, you know, children about trust, about, you know, not trusting strangers, and things like that. Maybe the concept of going into an empty house, maybe that's not a great tool of lesson, but I think that one can say that you can learn that not all strangers are bad strangers, because seven dwarves didn't harm her. They cared for her and they loved her. But the Wicked Witch, someone you know, can be very mean to you, and you know, just kind of like those little lessons. And taking in this little old lady, just because she's a little old lady, doesn't mean she's not dangerous.
Yeah, sure.
I like the writing and I like the style of what they were going for. I think back then it was something that worked. I'm not too thrilled today with the concept of a prince, someone you don't even know, gives you a kiss while you're asleep in a coffin, wakes you up and you just kind of, oh, this is my prince, I'm going to go with him.
In fairness, they had met.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure I want to teach that to little girls. Yeah. But as far as the movie itself, as long as you tell your children that, you know, what you're watching isn't real, you know, that is not life and that's not how it works. I think that's, watching these movies is fine.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. And I will be honest, like I said, I thought it was a lot worse because I didn't realize until, I don't know why I always blank this part out, but until I rewatched the movie this time, I just completely had no memory that the prince met Snow White before she leaves the castle. And so they'd already kind of met and had a little flirt around and the kind of
get
on the balcony moment and stuff. And I was like, all right, well, that's slightly better than just, you know, a prince turning up and kissing a random corpse. You know, it's just kind of super weird. You know?
But, necromancy is so creepy.
It's very weird and very convenient that the dwarves were like, she's too beautiful to bury. We'll put her in a glass coffin for everyone to see. Sure, that's not at all weird.
Well, that's not creepy.
What else were they going to do with all those gems? They were just locking them in a vault.
Yeah, exactly. I know. What was that about? Like, sell them, make some money. Like, you're working all day long to get
a bigger house where you can each have your own bedroom.
Thank you. I am a housekeeper. Yeah.
Because they're a hot mess. They needed help.
Yeah. Oh, but that's the kind of cuteness and the sweetness of it. Like I said, you've got to, you can't really apply real world logic to it because it's such a fairy tale type fantasy.
Exactly. Like the idea that she says to, you know, her animal friends, well, if I clean up, they'll see that I'm valuable and I can stay here. You're a stranger who just cleaned up someone's house that didn't ask you to. You broke an entry, and then you didn't break an entry and you cleaned. I'm not sure that that's reason enough to keep you. Like,
I have to slightly defend Snow White again here and say that at least it explains that she thinks that, and again, this was something that sadly would have happened in the time the movie set back in the 1800s. She thinks that they're kind of seven kids that have ended up orphaned, so that their parents have died, and that's why the place is the state it is.
Which is cute that she makes that assumption.
Yeah, she never assumes, oh, these are grown men that just lazy.
Exactly. It's like, oh, these poor children, they need help. And
yeah,
exactly.
I said, it's sadder when you realize that that probably was the kind of thing that happened. You could come across a cottage and be like, yeah, there were a family here, but the parents died of, I don't know, cholera or dysentery or any number of things, and left the kids to fend for themselves, you know? So, in that regard, she is kind of sweet, although it does give you, again, that kind of great comedy when they first arrive and they're terrified because there's somebody there. You know, she kind of yawns with a bed sheet on her and they assume it's a ghost and go diving out of the door, you know?
I found that interesting that grown men thought there was a ghost in their house. They made them sound silly. They really did with that one.
Oh, yeah, that's the point, though. I think, like I said, one of the other strengths for me of the writing in this, and the direction, actually, because it's got to be directed, is the physical comedy. And the fact that they play these things, like I said, it's almost like a vaudeville act or something. So you find yourself laughing at, you know, funny little things. And yeah, they have to act a little bit, you know, dopey, no pun intended, so that you can get those kinds of things. But I mean, they would be naive of the real ways of the world. They only, as far as we know, they've only ever lived with each other. They spend all of their days, like you said, just literally going to and from a mine where they dig gems. They don't bother tidying the house or anything, so it's not like they're not particularly house proud or anything. So I can believe they'd be naive enough to be like, "Ooh, ghosts are real," especially once you've actually already lived through that moment where Snow White goes into the woods and, man, how creepy are those freaking woods, man?
She's seeing scary things everywhere.
So if at any point the dwarves have been in the woods, they would be like scared of everything. No, the woods have encroached on our house. But, yeah, that's kind of and I mean, like I said, you can't apply, you learn you can't apply real world logic as soon as Snow White commands every creature like she's some kind of superhero, you know. That's they're doing the housework for her.
She's the original Dr. Doolittle.
Exactly, yeah, talking to the animals. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Like a land version of Aquaman, she can just talk to them and make them do stuff.
Exactly.
But it's sweet, and like I said, it starts off this kind of idea that you get with the Disney stuff of it. It's just going to charm you. Because if you look upon it cynically, you're never going to like this movie or any other Disney movie. If you
look upon
it as a childish thing and you're just charmed by it, then I think you will be. And like I said, because I was so young when I first watched it, I just remember being either charmed or laughing, like I said, at the funny bits, which I loved. You know, too many to mention, but off the top of my head, like Dopey in the soap, I think was a bit that I absolutely loved as a kid when he's going to get it and it slips all over the place and then he swallows it and he starts burping bubbles coming out of him and then, you know, his head becomes a little bubble for a while and he starts floating up and
it's I actually like when Grumpy refuses to wash his hands just because it was a girl who told him to wash his hands.
I don't think it was a gender thing. I think it was just like, nobody's going to tell me to wash my hands if I don't want to.
But he did express, if you listen to the movie, he did express that girls are nothing but trouble.
Oh, yeah, many a time. But one of the other things
won
I like
him
about,
over. She changed.
She did. She definitely won him
over. I can
over.
Change him.
Yeah, and to your point with regards to that, Sandy, I was just going to say, it's kind of commonplace to us now, but for a kid's animated film in, you know, 1938 or whatever, Grumpy gets an arc. He does go from, like, I'm against women generally, to, like, genuinely kind of loving her at the end.
Grows, yes.
Yeah, yes. And that's, I mean, this would probably be regarded more as like a series of comedic skits stuck together would be what people would expect. So seeing an actual story and an arc and a character that grows like that is pretty you know, progressive for that time anyway.
And very, very progressive. And the theme of, you know, quote unquote, boys thinking girls are gross, it was a theme that in the time that this movie was created was something that was truly believed. So
I was thinking that too. It's like one of seven people is surely going to have that opinion, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that time, absolutely. Oh, he pulled your hair. No, he's not being a bully. He just likes you, you know, which is now it's like, no, we're not going to do that now, but it's very different. I think that in the time that the movie was, you know, airing, this was perfectly normal and acceptable behavior. So I think that that works for then.
That's fair enough. I mean, I was just going to say that you could argue, I suppose, and I'd be intrigued to know you guys' thoughts on this particularly, that there's a lot of dated attitudes, and of course there's going to be in a film that's almost 100 years old. So obviously, you know, the idea that the Queen hates Snow White purely out of vanity because she's better looking, I think in a lot of ways, is something that apparently the live-action movie has removed in favour of, the Queen doesn't like her because she has a claim to the throne or something, and it's more about power than just, you know, who's fairer or whatever. And likewise, as you've already said, the idea that Snow White is a woman who seems to be, you know, oh, I'm just biding my time until a prince comes and takes me away and sweeps me away from all this, which is, it's a fantasy idea and it's cool. And if you're a woman who, you know, you have that romantic bone in you and that's what you feel, then fair enough, you're entitled to feel that way. But I certainly wouldn't necessarily think it would be something that would be foregrounded in a movie these days as being the norm, perhaps.
I think that the trope of women being in competition with women was something that was very, very popular at the time of this movie. So I think that the idea of bringing that into this movie made sense to these people. I think that that has actually caused more harm than good with female to female relationships and the idea that you're in constant competition with other women when you're not. You know, why should I be in competition with Sandy during this podcast? But in that trope, I would be. That's what we would be doing, trying to outdo each other. And it's, you know, and the idea that Snow White needs to have a prince, it's also very common in those times because women weren't allowed to have property or really hold any profession they wanted. There was limited jobs that they can do. And most women who married would lose their job because they no longer were expected to work. So the idea of having someone take care of her that would be worthy of, you know, of her time was a big deal then. And I think the trope worked then. It just doesn't quite work today. But like you said earlier, real world logic is not what needs to be applied here.
Absolutely, yeah, it is. It's a fantasy, and it's a fantasy of its time. Now, so what about you, Sandy? Any thoughts on kind of the arguably the sexist tropes or any of the other things we kind of talked about in the writing or whatever? Because we've been talking over you a bit.
Just that we've certainly evolved. Most of us, I like to believe, have certainly evolved past this. But even this film itself was a step in that evolution because, like you mentioned, it was a Grimm's fairy tale, and those are a bit darker. And even that is thought to have been based on, and I'm probably going to mispronounce, but Chion or Chion from Ovid's Metamorphoses, a story about a goddess who got both Apollo and Mercury's attention because of her appearance, because of how beautiful she was. And she was basically punished for it. And so, and that one turned out much worse. I won't even get into it. So
yeah, those ancient myths are really dodgy.
So this was a step in that evolution, and overall, there are some outdated tropes, but overall, it's sweet and innocent still, I believe.
Oh yeah, I think it's harmless
in the fairy tale sense. Yeah,
in the fairy tale sense, absolutely. It's not, like I said, it's not really aspirational, but then again, I'm not here to judge women who are happy to be homemakers, you know, and if Snow White is
great, absolutely not. Yes.
Fair enough.
You know what? Stay-at-home moms work twice as hard as anybody else.
100%.
So, Yeah.
I mean, they mostly don't have an entire forest full of animals to help them either. Which, you know,
and did you guys notice how Snow White gave them the harder jobs?
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't, but that's pretty smart.
I remember liking a lot of the kind of clever stuff. So I love the idea that they use the turtle's belly as like a washing board, because obviously of the time, that's what you would do to wash stuff. So that's what they use, because there's an animal there. Or one of the funniest bits when she catches them trying to sweep dirt under the rug, and she's like, not under the rug. And they sweep it into the little mouse hole in the skirting boards. And I knew what was coming, but I still laugh every time, is where the mouse pushes the dirt back out. Like, hang on, get out. It's my house. Don't you do that? Which I kind of love. I said, just so much great little physical comedy and funny moments in here as well. But yeah,
those are my favorite parts too. I'm glad you bring it up. But the genius ways they incorporate the animals. Same thing in, if I may quickly mention again, Cinderella. How the ingenious ways they think of using them as, you know, more than props, but how they incorporate them into that cleaning routine. It's just so fun. I could watch it a million times.
Definitely. And it became a Disney staple again, like along with everything else I mentioned, like the, you know, the idea of a Disney princess and the songs and everything else. I mean, the animal sidekick became a much more common thing because of early films like this, where the animals were not sidekicks. They were either main characters or there were groups of them. So things like Snow White or Bambi or whatever else led to, I think, even the point where you had films that were not really about that were about human characters. And they were always like, we've got to put in a funny animal sidekick to do something, otherwise it's not going to have that Disney sort of humor to it. So, yeah.
No, I absolutely agree. Yeah.
That's one of the things the live action ones, I think, kind of, they suffer a bit because it wants to lean away from that more, what they probably regard as more ridiculous things. So the animals have to be a bit more realistic, even though they can move around and talk. I mean, even in this movie, like I said, to bring it back to that, I do worry if the live action remake is going to embrace some of the things that make this fun, like those kind of funny animal moments or the kind of, you know, forest woodland helpers helping Snow White and the whistle while you work song and stuff. I think if you cut that out, it's going to really destroy the soul of the piece, not to sound too pompous about it. So
I agree with you. I think that that's what makes fantasy fantastic, right?
Yeah.
Is that you're embracing the impossible as possible. So one thing we know is impossible is birds and animals cleaning your house.
Yeah, exactly.
And, okay, you can whistle while you work all you want. That's possible. But, you know, Bambi isn't going to come in and clean your house. He more than likely could then destroy it. I mean, have we not seen the videos, right? But the thing is that, you know, if you're going to CGI the animals, then you could make them do whatever you want.
Absolutely, yeah. You'd be whistling while you were cleaning up bird poop is what you'd be doing in reality, but, you know.
Exactly.
Any other thoughts then on the writing plot before we move on from Sandy, from you, first of all?
No, I got it in. Y'all have covered pretty much everything.
Thanks for covering the classical part of things. I completely didn't get that as well. So, yeah, the ancient Greek roots of where these things lie, these fairy tales, is always interesting and very dodgy. It's already become more progressive, believe it or not, by the time it becomes a German fairy tale from what the original versions were.
And what's funny is that name, Chion or Kion, if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, it does mean snow in Greek.
Oh, wow. Okay. That makes sense then. Fair enough. What about you, Nita? Anything before we move on to direction?
No. I think we covered.
Cool.
I think just worth noting, despite all these different origins, this is the one we think of as Snow White.
Oh, yes. Definitely. And I touch on that in my conclusion. So. I think it's become so iconic, even though there's been multiple remakes even since. And boy, I mean, off the top of my head, I could list several even before you get into not strict remakes, but things like Once Upon a Time or whatever, which lean heavily into using that story. And yeah, as you said, the thing we always think of is this movie. This is the definitive version of this. So yeah, in regards to that, talking about the direction, which is a big part of that, I will tell you that the production was supervised by David Hand and was drawn by Hand and was directed by a team of sequence directors, including Perse Pierce, William Cottrell, Larry Morey, Wilfred Jackson, and Ben Sharpstein. I have yet another third quote from Walt Disney. who says, the first duty of the cartoon is not to picture or duplicate real action or things as they actually happen. Exactly what we were just saying, Nita, basically. But to give a caricature of life and action. To picture on the screen things that have run through the imagination of the audience to bring to life dream fantasies and imaginative fancies that we've all thought of during our lives or have had pictured to us in various forms during our lives. I definitely feel that we cannot do the fantastic things based on the real unless we first know the real. This point should be brought out very clearly to all new men and even the older men. So he's basically saying, you know, get a handle on the way things move and the way people move in order to animate it, but then don't be afraid to, you know, show things that aren't realistic and lean into that caricature more, which, like I said, is kind of exactly what we were saying about don't be afraid of doing that.
Or the two kids in a trench coat gag. That wouldn't really work in real life.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. with the direction again, no rotoscoping was used for the depiction of Queen Grimhilda, which is apparently the evil queen's name. It's not mentioned on screen, but apparently it is. I think that's from the old fairy tale. The animators preferred drawing the queen over Snow White and devoted more attention to her depiction. The animators found that she, quote, was more real and complex as a woman, more erotic and driven to desperate acts by her magic mirror. Particular attention was paid to her, quote, lovely, cruel mouth and eyes and her graceful movements. I feel like a lot of these animators need to get a room.
I think they were a little bit in love with her. Yeah. I agree.
Was everything all right at home, animators? I'm curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. During the production phase of the film, Grim Natwick and Norman Ferguson were tasked with refining the design and overall visual appearance of Queen Grimhilda and Snow White. For Queen Grimhilda, they studied the faces of several beauties of the era. Among the ones cited as visual inspiration in various sources were Gail Sondergaard, Marlene Dietrich, Joan Crawford, and Greta Garbo. For the Queen's clothes, they mostly used a preserved medieval statue of Uta von Ballenstadt from 1000 to 1046, a German aristocrat most famous for her striking visual depiction in the Naumburg Cathedral. So, yeah. Then I've just got a bunch of kind of personal notes on the direction. So again, any thoughts on the direction, as it were, in this movie? And again, Sandy, I'll come to you to mix it up a bit.
Just looking up, I was curious, and it does bear on this subject, if the animation or the casting for voices was done first, and the animation was done first, and so they were picking a voice to match the animation, and the directing then it follows would have been helping them match that animation. And I think that was just really well done, as far as not only them casting correctly, but just the way it does match up, the lilt in her voice and the sneezes with Sneezy. It's just all really, really well done. So I would say, you know, excellent marks in the directing.
I'm glad you said that, because it didn't even occur to me, voice direction, and obviously that's a very big and important part as well. I was purely thinking of the way it was animated and the kind of life that was given to it in direction in that regards. But yeah, voice direction is a hugely important part of animated anything. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So how about you, Nita?
I think that it didn't occur to me until Sandy mentioned that they did the drawings first before they picked the voice actors. The other way around wouldn't have worked. I think that this definitely helps match up those characters that they want on screen with the appropriate voice. And I think that that's fantastic. I think that they did a really good job considering the time that this film was created. They were really ahead of themselves, technologically speaking. And I think that that's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, for sure.
And their coloring and the costumes you mentioned, but also the coloring of, like, Snow White's dress is so classic for a reason. It still persists to this day in that form. And one thing I do clearly remember is having a coloring book with a lot of these scenes. In fact, as I'm watching the animation, several of the scenes really stick out, like the mother, this evil stepmother over her bottles and everything in her basement, fixing the, and you know, several pictures of Snow White. And I just remember how much I loved coloring her dress.
It's definitely become the iconic de facto thing. I remember, like I said, we did a school play when I was around 7 or 8 based on the Disney version of Snow White. And I remember they painstakingly recreated the Snow White costume of the blue with the puffy sleeves and red in it and the yellow dress and the little bow in the hair. So, yeah. And I do notice they've done that again for the live action remake. They haven't veered at all away from the iconic look of the character, even though I think the haircut does nothing whatsoever to flatter Rachel Zegler. I mean, maybe should have considered that they could have changed that.
Poor it's not girl. Yeah. And it's the besides the coloring, but the shading and use of shadow. And my favorite part of the animation is the way the gems sparkle in the mine.
Oh, I'm glad I have that exact same note. It looks beautiful. It really is so beautiful.
And,
as I mentioned earlier, everybody get your drinks ready. I watched this on 4K, which I went out and bought specifically.
I want to hear more about that.
I was
going to
say, I wasn't going to because I already owned the film on Blu-ray, but as I was doing my research, I read that they did a really good, fantastic 4K kind of upscale conversion for this, and that it became the de facto version that they use on Disney Plus and everything because it was so good, even though it's like the oldest film they've ever done that process to. And you can really tell the animation just pops so well and it's so fluid. I don't know if that's a result of the upscaling or what, but I'd noticed it seeming a lot more, like I said, of a fluid animation, less jerky, and it seems like it flows so much better, which I think helps the story itself to move along better. And like you said, moments that were already stunning just look amazing. The shining of the jewels in the mine when it got there, I was like, wow, this looks incredible. You know, and having even like the classical style that Snow White is doing in, it always felt kind of ethereal, and it's very 40s. She's kind of got a, for me, kind of a very Betty Boopish kind of face and everything.
That's true.
And that kind of, again, it comes out all the more when you've actually got the details crisper and cleaner in front of you. And it's
I will say her proportions are more understated. As opposed to our later princesses.
Referring back to the animation, like I said, one of the things I did note, again, which I don't think I've really registered, is that as an adult, you can kind of now see that it's a corner-cutting exercise, but I think it really works, that it opens with a kind of live-action storybook opening and then gives you a lot of the exposition in text. And that happens again at the end of the movie. It feels, to me, a tiny bit rushed because it kind of, you see Snow White eat the apple and she's lost forever or whatever. And then it cuts to the book opening and saying, and then this is what happened. The dwarves did this, and then the prince came along. And I was like, all right, that would have been an awful pain in the butt to animate a lot of that stuff, which is pure exposition. And I think it's perhaps cheating, but it's also really effective the way they just did it as a little bit
agreed.
Of, you've got to read, you know, to pick it up. And, you know, it's
going
to be
I good to read. Their spiel at that time is we're bringing a book to life that otherwise wouldn't have been able to have been done without animation.
Absolutely.
Correct.
It brings to mind, and again, this might not seem related, but it weirdly kind of is, when they first, the very first Superman movie came out, it opens with them opening an Action Comics and then zooming in as if it's like, we're bringing this comic to life. And I just remember thinking, oh, that's really cool. So I think that's kind of perhaps a reference back to this, which was kind of, we're bringing a fairy tale storybook into life now, and the stories are now going to be lively. So, yeah. But I do want to shout out a few things with regards to the particular animation while we're on the subject. First of all, again, it's 1938 when this came out, and you've got effective water ripple animation when they're kind of washing their hands and stuff. That's difficult to do even now. And they weren't afraid to go with it. Just the sheer amount that's going on with the animals all cleaning and stuff, and they managed to keep it, you know. There are apparently some small animation mistakes, but I've got to be honest, I didn't spot any of them. I thought it looked pretty fine.
Even the dwarves, when they are coming home, when Snow White first arrives and they're walking through that valley and their shadows, how they grow up on the wall and the lights and shadows in the valley, even though the sun's not shown setting, you know where the sun is, you know where the light source is. And I really appreciate that scene, just the foreground in darkness and where the light shines in the valley, just really neat.
Definitely. I have a little bit about that in the VFX production design that I'll get to, because it kind of explains where that idea comes from, the more kind of the use of light and shadow and the more gothic elements. But I'll get to that in a minute, because I did want to also shout out related to that kind of water thing that I was mentioning, the animated rain in the end sequence. Again, that's not easy to do. They could have decided that it wasn't raining when the queen died or whatever, but they
exactly went for it. Mm-hmm. You really got to give credit to these animators that didn't have the technology that animators today have. No hate on today's animators, they do an awesome job. But when you're working with so little that you can make such a film, that really says something.
Absolutely. Yeah, like every movement, hand-drawn.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So I have a little bit of information regarding that, that again, I'll get into in a second, regarding the animation. First of all, I want to say, under the direction, I was really amazed when I registered what was happening, that part of the reason I think that I'm scared of the kind of evil hag version of the queen is she addresses us directly. It's like she's breaking the fourth wall. Like, she's not talking to anybody else, so it's she literally talks to you. And I'm like, that must have, no wonder that messed with my head when I was a kid, because that's why we're like, she can see me. Ew. And I've always kind of thought this from the first time I saw the movie, but her death scene is surprisingly dark, especially when you think this is the first Disney movie, the very first villain death, and she just, you know, she dies in a horrific accident of lightning hitting her, and then vultures are shown to go and carry away her corpse and eat it after she's been crushed by a rock, just to emphasize that she definitely did.
But didn't you know, Michael, she really literally was looking into your soul?
That's what I'm saying. It's probably her fault. Now that I think of it, it's probably her fault why I was so afraid of getting dressed or undressed in front of the TV as a child. Please tell me I'm not the only one.
I'm not gonna lie, I can't say that was a particular bugbear of mine. No, so that may be a you problem, Sandy.
No, truly.
Sorry. Yeah. The last note I wanted to make about this, because I have a little bit of information regarding it. I really love the way the mirror animation is done. I think it really works, the way it's all the pieces come together. Although I did read and I wish I'd put the guy's name down, but I sadly didn't. The guy who did the animation of the actual little theatrical mask part of it apparently worked really hard on it and was very annoyed when he saw the final film because it was obscured behind sort of smoke and the wobbly effect and at some points flames and stuff. And he thought it was just going to be the mask itself appearing there. And I sympathize with him, but I do think this works better, honestly, what we got. I think it adds to the ethereal weirdness. And again, didn't realize till I was researching the movie this time that apparently the thing inside of the mirror is supposed to be the queen's familiar, like a kind of captured demon that a witch would have. I just assumed it was a magical mirror, you know? But
I remember in the beginning she refers to him as slave
and come forth. If, by the way, if you want to learn more about the potential backstory of the magic mirror and get some cool Snow White Easter eggs, I thoroughly recommend the film Wish from a few years back, which is very underrated. It didn't do well at the box office, but it's a really good Disney film. And yeah, lots of Snow White references in there because it was to celebrate 100 years of Disney. So yeah, that's all I'll say about that. What was I going to say? So yeah, we'll jump on to the VFX and production design then, because I have a little bit I wanted to read out, like I said, just about the ins and outs of where this came from. And I think it gives you a new appreciation for the film. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, as well as the two Disney films that followed it, as I mentioned earlier, or hinted at, were influenced by German expressionist films such as Nosferatu, 1922, and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, 1920, both of which were recommended by Disney to his staff, which may be also why I love lots of parts of these movies, because I adore German expressionism, and those are two of my favorites that we mentioned just then. This influence is particularly evident in the scenes of Snow White fleeing through the forest, and the Queen's transformation into the witch. The latter scene was also inspired by Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, 1931, to which Disney made specific reference in story meetings. I think that's kind of obvious, especially once you hear it, you can kind of see where they're coming from. Animator Seamus Culhane recalled drawing the dwarves' march home in the hi-ho scene as one of the toughest assignments of his career. Although six of the dwarves were marching at the same tempo, he had to give each his own body language suited to the character, and he had to map each individual walk with a blue pencil and ruler because of the unusual angles and perspectives used in the sequence. Then there was Dopey, bringing up the rear, hopping out of step with the others, but he still had to be smoothly integrated into the action. Describing the sheer amount of painstaking hand-drawn labor this involved, Culhane said, and I quote, "I worked 6 months on that goddamn thing, and it doesn't last a minute on screen."
That must feel horrible, though. I'm with him.
I mean, that's it's at least it ends up on screen. It's not like anything's cut. It's just that that's, you know, it goes to show it took six months to do 1 minute of animation for this thing. You know, that's how they had to do it back then. Like you said, everything was painstakingly hand-drawn. It wasn't just a matter of clicking a few things on a computer and letting it go, you know? No offense to people that do that. It's a skill within itself, but yeah, certainly not the same kind of intensive labor. Definitely
not the same intense labor for sure.
Yeah, and if you are a bit of a Disney nerd and you like to look for the hidden Mickey in things, the one in this movie is formed by three stones on the wall behind the Queen as she strides down to the basement to perform her spell. I know nothing about hidden Mickeys. I just read that when I was researching this movie, and now I'm truly fascinated and want to have a deep dive and look into where all the others are. I completely forgot to look when I was watching the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, every time I've heard that before, but I never remember to look by the time we get there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, and the last thing I want to mention with regards to this, just general kind of overall feeling, watching the kind of Blu-ray that came with the 4K disc, there's a little bit of information about a couple of sequences that were cut from the movie, one of which involved the dwarves eating soup that had been prepared for them and then having a little comedy thing with that, and one quite detailed thing about them building a bed for Snow White and then her ending up in their bed and them ending up in the one they'd kind of built for her and everything. And again, it's quite an involved thing. These were storyboarded, but they were never made into an actual sort of animated stage. You can watch them as deleted scenes on the Blu-ray if you happen to have it, or you can watch a section which I found fascinating. I watched yesterday about something called Snow White Returns, which never actually happened, and it still amazes me how it hasn't happened to this day, because it was basically an outline was given for a potential sequel to Snow White, which would probably have been a short, or at least a shorter movie, which would have essentially incorporated these two deleted scenes, because they'd already done all of the storyboarding and everything for them. So it basically would have had Snow White giving a letter to the dwarf saying that she was going to come by for her annual visit, them panicking and deciding that they need to make a gift, and that's why they make a bed for Snow White, because she's coming and they want to give her something. And then when they get home to give her the gift, she's already arrived and she's been making the soup, and that's when you get the soup eating sequence and everything. So I just, like I said, they found a box with all of this in, and it's all mapped out there for you. I still can't believe they haven't just made that. I think it would make money, and it's all there for you. I say, Disney, just do it. Go on. Why not?
I'm with you. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, put it on Disney Plus. You're always looking for content for there.
Exactly. That would be perfect, though.
Definitely, yeah. So do you have any thoughts on anything I haven't mentioned in direction or production design or special effects as regards what they were in the time?
Nothing else I can think of.
Yeah, nothing else I can think of. I think that they were ahead of their time. They did a great job.
Definitely, definitely. I want to briefly touch on music and sound, because there's not a whole lot to say other than it's really good. I like the songs in this, and it began the Disney film tradition of incorporating, like I said, songs into most of their animated classic films. One thing I didn't know was that Snow White became the first American film to ever have a soundtrack album that was released in conjunction with the film. So, again, something that we just take for granted as part of movies, you know, getting a soundtrack album, didn't happen until Snow White, so something else we have to thank it for. And just quickly, like I said, all the songs are really good. They've become iconic. We know almost all of them, if not all. And so I want to quickly go around and ask what your favourite song in the movie is. Sandy, I'm going to come to you first.
I think The Whistle While You Work is pretty iconic and something I remember even using when I was young and having to clean my room or having to set about some task I really didn't want to do. I would imagine being Snow White and having, you know, forest friends to help me. Just like you did with the podcast, only we're real.
We hope. yeah. Cool.
But that's the one, yeah, that's the one I remember. And then Someday My Prince Will Come is pretty iconic as well. But I just remember mostly drawing help from that Whistle While You Work song and you know, being able to whistle.
Nice. And what about you, Nita?
You know, I have to agree with her. When you asked that question, the first one that came to mind was Whistle As You Worked. I thought that that was so much fun. Definitely iconic, you know, and it's a song that you can kind of play, you know, and at any point in time, you know, and it'll always be there. And it's something that anyone can sing.
Yeah.
Definitely. Which I love. It's, you know, the inclusivity of the song itself, you know?
For sure, yeah, yeah. Awesome. I have to say my personal favorite of the songs is Hi Ho, but I do want to give a special shout out. Do either of you, are either of you aware of the version of Whistle While You Work that became popular to mock the Nazis a few years after the movie came out?
No.
No.
It became so popular, and it was, forgive me, I'm going to have to do a slight performance, so, you know, take this with a pinch of salt. But it basically goes, whistle while you work, Hitler is a jerk, he's half barmy, so's his army, whistle while you work.
Oh my goodness.
It shows how iconic that the film became, that this was like, what, 5 or 6 years later, when World War II broke out, and people were using that song to mock the Nazi party in the film, from the film, sorry. So, yeah. I can't believe you guys haven't heard that. Maybe it's a British thing. Maybe we all just did it over here.
Maybe. I mean, it's possible we just haven't heard it. Yeah. But, yeah, that sounds like something they would do at that time. It's yeah, to take an iconic yeah. song and yeah. Create this, you know,
yeah,
this exactly. kind of mocking song. I like the idea, though.
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah. Back when we used to hate Nazis instead of, you know, half of the government being with them.
Exactly.
Anyway, so yeah.
It is kind of amazing to think it came out at that point in history, though, because I think of it as being from my childhood. I would have thought, you know, if I didn't have some place to reference it, I would have thought this came out when I was a kid. And it's just amazing to think it came out when our, you know, grandparents were kids.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, definitely. Exactly.
I mean, it's when you look at the number of generations that must have or could have grown up with it, you must be onto the fourth by now, you know, at least of people that have grown up watching this movie. And yeah, I mean, we talked about Nita when we were discussing King Kong, how amazing it is that that film is almost 100 years old, but we still watch it and it still holds up. I mean, the same thing is true of this. I mean, these are films, like we said, King Kong was from 1933, this is from 1938, and they still work. They're still brilliant movies, you know, so
yeah.
I'm pleased that we still have them and we can still watch them, and, you know, they weren't lost to time. So then before I jump into the next bit, which is the audience critics' response, and then we give our own thoughts on the movie and favourite bits and pieces, do you guys have anything else you wanted to bring up before I do that?
Mm-mm.
No.
Cool. Right, well, as I say, I will jump into the next section, which is the kind of critics' response to this. I always have to kind of clarify this in case you're new to cinema classics, but we often do an audience response, and on Cinema Classics, I opted not to do that because we're looking at classic movies, so it feels like it would be redundant. A lot of it would just be positive, I assume, because these movies have a reputation for a reason. But I do like to still include a critic's response because I like to see how the film guarded that reputation and how kind of the professional critics of the time and contemporary critics kind of view the film, if there's been a change. I find it fascinating. So, I'm going to jump straight in and tell you that the film was a tremendous critical success, with many reviewers hailing it as a genuine work of art recommended for both children and adults. Although film histories often state that the animation of the human characters was criticized, more recent scholarship found that contemporary reviewers actually praised the realistic style of the human animation, with several stating that audiences had forgotten that they are watching animated humans rather than real ones. Frank S. Nugent of the New York Times felt that, quote, Mr. Disney and his technical crew have outdone themselves. The picture more than matches expectations. It's a classic, as important cinematically as The Birth of a Nation or The Birth of Mickey Mouse. Nothing quite like it has been done before, and already we have gone impolite enough to clamour for an encore. Again, get it out. You still haven't done it, and it's right there. Variety observed that, quote, so perfect is the illusion, so tender the romance and fantasy, so emotional are certain portions when the acting of the characters strikes a depth comparable to the sincerity of human players, that the film approaches real greatness. Harrison's reports wrote, Snow White was, quote, entertainment that should be enjoyed by everyone. Intelligent adults will marvel at the mechanical ingenuity that went into the making of it, and it is something to marvel at, for at times the characters seem lifelike. That is brought about by the expert synchronization of the action with the music and the dialogue. Speaks to what you were saying, Sandy, basically. Noted filmmakers such as Sergei Eisenstein and Charlie Chaplin praised Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs as a notable achievement in cinema. Eisenstein went so far as to call it the greatest film ever made. Wow. The film inspired MGM to produce its own fantasy film, The Wizard of Oz, which was released a year after Snow White's official full release in 1939. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is referred by many critics as one of the greatest animated films in history. Rolling Stone ranked it fourth on its list of the greatest animated films of all time, calling it the one that changed the future of animation. Time magazine ranked the film as the 13th best animated film of all time. Harper's Bazaar listed the film as the number one animated film of all time, crediting it as the one that started it all. And in 1987, Snow White was inducted into the Hollywood Walk of Fame, making her so far the only Disney princess to have been so. Snow White was nominated for Best Musical Score at the Academy Awards in 1938, and the next year, Walt Disney was awarded an honorary Oscar for the film. The award was unique, consisting of one normal-sized plus seven miniature Oscar statuettes that were presented to Disney by Shirley Temple. And if you haven't seen that clip, I do recommend looking it up. It's one of the sweetest things you will ever see. It's, yeah, Shirley Temple asking Mr. Disney if he loves his little Oscar statuette and seven others, and him say, oh, I think they're absolutely marvelous, in that kind of old-timey way that people do, you know. Yeah, and again, if you're a regular on Cinema Classics, you know it's time to grab your drinks, because in 1989, the U.S. Library of Congress deemed this film culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant and selected it as one of the first 25 films for preservation in the National Film Registry. Yeah, the American Film Institute ranked it among the 100 greatest American films, and it also named the film as the greatest American animated film of all time in 2008. So, safe to say, popular.
Yeah, so, absolutely, yeah. Popular.
So yeah, I'm going to jump on now then into our favorite character moment in line, and we'll give our conclusion and our scores and then get out of here. So yeah, I do this on my episodes. I know DK does an Uncle Classics, but I like to do this just for a bit of background into what hit you from the film. So first of all, we're going to do our favorite character, and I'll come to you first, Sandy. Why not? Because I just want to mix it up a bit. Who's your favorite character in the film and why?
I think my favorite character is Doc, just because of how funny he talked, how he kind of was the one that directed all the dwarfs and kept them in line and, you know, convinced them to give in to Snow White and go wash their hands, and kind of led the charge, and his sadness when she fell into her deep sleep. It was just, he's just my favorite character, I would say.
Awesome. I can certainly see why. Absolutely. What about you, Nita?
You know, it's so funny. I was going to say Doc.
Okay.
I was, but I said, okay, so let me see who's my second favorite, because for all the same reasons, I love Doc. But you gotta love Dopey. Dopey is so sweet and so innocent, you know? And I love the way that he just, you know, wants to make her happy.
Yeah. Awesome. I've read quite a bit of stuff about Dopey, actually, because there are some people that speculate that he may be kind of adopted by the dwarves, because he's obviously, as you probably noticed, the only one without a beard. And so he looks different to all the others. And there's been some people that have speculated that he may be just a regular human child. And that's why he kind of can't talk yet, and why he seems dopey to the dwarfs, because he's not actually an adult. And if you went back, he may grow older. They're kind of a very Will Ferrell elf type situation, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know if I believe that. I think it's just to differentiate his character and make him stand out a bit, because you've got seven characters. You need somebody to be a bit larger than life. But still fascinating to think of, I think.
It is fascinating to think of, but I like the idea that he's just different, a different kind of dwarf than they were, and that's okay.
And he's most the comic relief, really.
Yes, yeah. He's the comic relief of the group.
That scene, again, it's so well animated when he sticks the two diamonds or whatever they are in his eyes and just taps Doc or whoever it is on the shoulder and looks and says, so cool. My favorite character, it occurs to me that this is my show and thus my rules, so I'm going to count the dwarfs as one overall character and pick them, because they are, to me, just a triumph of characterization, physical comedy, voice performance, just absolutely brilliant. So yes, you can argue I've picked seven characters there, but I don't care, it's my show. So, so there we go.
Cheater.
Boo. What was your favorite moment or scene in the film, Sandy?
I think my favorite moment is, I had mentioned it before, with the animals helping Snow White clean, and even a little bit later when she's making them pies and how the birds stamp out the fringe around the edge of the pie and help decorate it with each of their names. just kind of both of those scenes are among my favorites, just because of like having the animal friends and the sweetness of it, the fun aspect, the songs that are happening during those times, really probably my favorite scenes.
Yeah, it is kind of imaginative fantasy brought to life. I definitely see where you're coming from. Hey, what about you, Nita?
I absolutely love the moment when she's asleep and they're trying to figure out, you know, this ghost under the bed situation. I thought that that was so sweet. The innocence of it, you know, it never really occurred to them to take the blanket off and see what was underneath it. I just absolutely love the innocence of it. In these adults, because they were adults, they were not children, but they had this childlike mentality that I absolutely adored.
Oh, awesome. Fair enough. I should have said this earlier, but I'd like to shout out, by the way, if you are a fan of those kind of physical comedy type scenes, you really should watch the deleted scenes, because particularly the one where they build the bed and then they have to end up sleeping in it that they've made for Snow White. There's an ongoing thing where they all jump into the bed when they realize that she's kind of asleep in theirs. And it fits six of them and not seven. And so one of them keeps on getting popped out whenever they all jump in. And it becomes a running thing of like one of them running around and popping the other guy out the other side and then jumping around and then Dopey being left out and jumping at the bottom and then popping up to the top and another one popping out again. And it's just, it really would, I think, be really good if it was animated. And even in the storyboard form, I found myself like really laughing along with it and thinking, this is great stuff. But my overall favorite sequence, perhaps speaking to the kind of horror fan and the inner goth within me, I love the scary wood sequence. I just think it's so imaginative and cool the way it anthropomorphizes all the things into looking like, you know, they've all got eyes or they're, you know, the twigs are crocodiles and they all feel like terrifying things that are coming for Snow White. And it's such a great little scene in cinema history, I think, for me, that I really love it. Do you have a favorite line in the movie then, Sandy?
I do, and it comes from the scene that Nita was just describing, and it's from Doc when he's saying, "Now, men, search every crook and nanny, or hook and granny, or crooked fan, search everywhere." This is how it's supposed to say, crooked fanny. It's just so funny.
Yeah.
That was my favorite line too, to be honest, because he just every time he tried to say something very clever, he just got himself all twisted.
And that was such a funny bit that it literally became just the entire thing that Porky Pig is in the cartoons. Yes. If you're trying to say something, stumbling and then saying something different, it's really funny. Actually, my favorite line is, "What are womanly wiles? I don't know, but I'm a ginnam."
Yes.
Perfect summation of Grumpy there. He doesn't like women, but he doesn't even know why. He's heard they have something gone about them, and you know, I'm against it.
Exactly. Yeah. He's against it. He don't know why. He just is.
Exactly. They got cooties or something, probably.
Yes.
So we're going to jump now into our conclusions on our score out of 5, and then we can wrap things up. Nita, would you like to go first with this?
You know, I have to say that I'm going to give this a 5, because I think that given its time, it was an excellent film. It covered all the bases of its time. And even though the world has evolved, it's still a classic that remains in everyone's heart. I don't think there's a parent in the world that doesn't want their kid to watch this.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Cool. Well, we have a parent with us, so we'll ask her, Sandy, what are your thoughts on this movie then, and your score?
I would also give it a 5 because it is classic. Again, the animation is really so beautiful, but it's also an important movie because it set a standard. It said, you know, our children are worth investing in, even though it wasn't strictly, I mean, it was for adults' entertainment and wonder as well, but it really set a standard. Like you mentioned, MGM then wanted to release a fantasy film after that, which Wizard of Oz, which was iconic, but everybody had to do better. They had to have better music, better story, better animation, and now look where we are. So I just really love the film for all those things and everything Nita said as well.
Awesome. Yeah, you've covered a lot of what I said, but just in a very different way. And again, I always apologize for this. Apologies that my very pompous conclusion, but I think I like to pretend that I'm a film journalist sometimes, and it's the closest I'll get to writing for film professionally. So I just said, some films extend far beyond the cinema screen. They embed themselves in pop culture, enter the zeitgeist, and become part of our shared history. Even if you've never seen this film, and you should, you know about the Magic Mirror, the Poisoned Apple, and at least some of the dwarves' names. And if you picture Snow White, she's almost certainly in the now iconic Disney costume. It may feel like this film has always existed, arriving fully formed and passed down through generations. But studying just how much went into making it only deepens my appreciation. More importantly, it's simply great. If it wasn't, none of its legacy would matter. The story is adapted brilliantly. The animation was groundbreaking, and the pioneering characterization, musical interludes, and iconic imagery set a new standard. Walt and his team could only dream it would become so deeply embedded in our collective consciousness. Why has it endured? Perhaps the sheer talent behind it, the evident care and effort poured into every frame, or the timeless power of a fairy tale well told. Whatever the reason, it has charmed audiences for decades, myself included. I can't help but smile at the dwarves' antics, be awed by the Queen's terrifying presence, and yes, fall a little bit in love with Snow White herself. There's a reason this film launched a cinematic empire spanning 63 films and nearly a century. Of all the Disney remakes, this upcoming one seems the most like a, quote, fool's folly. But then again, they said that about this once, and how wrong they were. And I also gave it 5 out of 5. So if you bear with me while I try and work out this complicated average.
Oh, can you need some help from your forest friends?
Carry the one. If I work that out correctly, that is a 5 out of 5 and a perfect score for a very deserving, very important movie, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I see, I'm thrilled. I wasn't sure that would be the case, or if you guys would mark it down for anything. And I think it deserves to be regarded as a perfect score, like I said, just for the sheer impact it had on cinema and on our lives, you know, as kids and onwards. So, yeah. And so we reach our own happily ever after, or at least until the next episode. Thank you to my brilliant guests. This has been a fantastic discussion, and I've really enjoyed it. So thank you, first of all, Nita, for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me. I always enjoy hanging out with you.
Awesome. You didn't mind not having DK here then?
I did. I did mind that. It's breaking my heart. You know, I'm going to go cry when this is over.
I'll make sure to keep this in the edit so that it can be like a plea to him to come on.
Yeah, our episode. He needs to get it together. You know, the Simian crew needs to come back.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm looking into films because we've got a lot planned for this year. But I'm looking into you know, Monkey and Ape related movies for next year to put on, yes, just deliberately so that we can join up to review them. Yes, that's a reference to the fact that we randomly ended up reviewing Planet of the Apes and King Kong just within a few weeks of each other last year, audience, if you were curious. So yeah, and where can people find you on the internet then, Nita?
You can find me on the Sci-Fi Queens on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, Threads, on YouTube, the Sci-Fi Queens podcast. Our next episode will be March 7th at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And we're going to be talking about Lower Decks and review the entire 5 seasons.
Awesome. And our review of Star Trek Lower Decks is already up on our sister channel, which is, yes, Star Trek, which Nita did join us for, I have to say. And we had a fantastic time.
We had a great time.
You, myself, and Dag, it was fantastic talking about all. And DK actually is on that one as well, bizarrely. So there we go. He hadn't quite run away yet. So yeah, no, I have to. I don't know if I've actually done this before, but I have to thoroughly recommend, put my voice to recommending the Sci-Fi Queens podcast.
Oh, thank you.
They're all very knowledgeable and also, you know, very socially conscious and you know, very forward thinking as well. Progressive is the word, I think, because you did a whole thing about Black History Month and
yes, you know, we did
shouting mm-hmm. out female voices in science and Black voices in the art and things. And I think that's something we, you know, it's not something we do in the podcast, not for any particular reason, though I always do make a point of mentioning if any of those things come up in the films we review. But I do think it's a great thing.
And, yes, one thing we always do in Sci-Fi Queens podcast is we elevate women in real science who are contributing to real science. We elevate the women who have contributed to sci-fi in television and movies and in books as well. We will elevate male voices as well, but our priority will be to elevate a woman's voice and a woman's knowledge and contribution.
absolutely. But yeah, thoroughly recommend that. Do please do check that out if you're a sci-fi fan or just a fan of like listening to people who know what they're talking about review things, which is always fun. So yeah, and thanks again, Sandy, for joining us for yet another classic review.
Yeah, if there's room on the plane, I would love to get on this guilt trip, because it's been a very long time since I've seen DK on a podcast. Oh.
That's right. Yes.
Okay, I'll keep this in the edit as well and consider this a double shout out. I'm not at all envious of the fact that nobody's here. Nobody's clamoring for me to join them or anything, but whatever.
Because you're always here, brother. Yeah. You are always present.
Fair enough. I won't be too offended. Yeah, that's fine. I'll pass that on. But no, seriously, thank you. You've been a good voice in the cinema classics just generally, and always value your opinions and insights. Do you have anywhere people could find you on the internet, or are you avoiding it wisely these days?
Still keeping a low profile. Although, and not that you haven't done, you know, your duty in mentioning it before, but now I'm really intrigued by the Sci-Fi Queens podcast, so I'm going to look for that.
Oh, wonderful.
Look it up on YouTube. Yes. Yeah, their YouTube channel is the best place, I think, to find it, because they do a lot of hard work on it. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. If you are in the audience, thank you for joining us for this examination of a little piece of film history. As regards our own links to all our social media are always going to be in the episode description, and as always, will be popping up on screen if you're watching in YouTube, on YouTube, or probably in our a little outro that you can hear Lady V and Dulcet Tones and see them on there as well. So yeah, join us again then in just 5 days' time as Silver Screen Original reunites our own Edgar Wright fan club, myself, DK, and Michael Whaley, to look at all things 60s, Soho, and spooky. And until next time, remember what the customer waiting at the photo shop said: someday my prince will come. Bye for now.
Bye. Bye.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Cinema Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Cinema Classics is hosted, produced, researched, scripted, and edited by Michael Wilson. Additional material by DK. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Links to all of these places can be found via the link tree in each episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production created by Mike Wilson. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Join us again next time, and hopefully this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Here's looking at you, kid.
Cut!